Welcome to another edition of the Postcast, powered by BasketballNews.com. I'm your host, Jameson Welsh, alongside three-time NBA champion, James Posey. Pose, what's good?
What's good, J-Mo?
All is well. So just want to mention, before we get started, make sure to listen and subscribe on all your favorite platforms that you subscribe to for podcasts and other listening materials. Today, we're joined by someone who has so many accolades, it would take us all day to list them. Welcome, Clyde Drexler. Clyde, what's going on?
Guys, I am good. It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood. Let me just tell you. How's everything?
What's up, Clyde?
What's up, Pose? How you doing, man?
I'm good.
How's everything?
I'm good. Appreciate you taking the time. I mean, I know I'm taking away from, you know, your golf time and everything, but I appreciate your time.
Anything for you, neighbor. Anything.
I still need my lessons, though. I'm out there. I'm trying, though.
Hey, just keep doing it. You'll get it.
I appreciate it. So I want to start off. When did your love of the game of basketball start?
Oh, Pose, I always loved basketball. But the thing we did was when I was younger, we played seasonal sports. So baseball season, we played baseball. Football season, we played football. And basketball season, guess what? We played basketball. And so as I began to grow around the age of 14 or 15, I started to specifically think about more about basketball, even though I was a little bit better in probably baseball and football at that time.
At baseball, okay. So at what point did you made your mind up, hey, this is what I really want to do? And so now is you think about college, yes, you're going through your sophomore, junior, senior year. How did you end up at University of Houston?
Well, you know, pretty much in the 11th grade, I was playing baseball and I was playing basketball, both two sport athletes, right? Well, the basketball coach came to the baseball field and said, that's it. You're not playing this sport anymore. So that pretty much did it, right? Uh-huh. So, you know, I grew to 6'7", Pose. And back then you didn't want to be tall for nothing. So if you're going to be tall, at least play basketball, right?
Right. Be wasted height, right?
Exactly.
Now, Clyde, you went to the University of Houston. When you first got there, you also was joined by a guy named Hakeem Olajuwon at the time. How was that first interaction? Because obviously, you know, you're from Houston. He's coming from a different country and speaking a different language. How did that first interaction go about?
It was interesting, guys, because, you know, I think I was all of 18, and I think I just enrolled in my freshman year. And the best player there was a guy named Rob Williams. And we all wanted to play with Rob Williams. Well, a month after we enrolled, Hakeem Olajuwon comes to campus. And obviously, you know, he's tall, he's athletic, he's not polished yet, but Guy Lewis was a perfect coach for Hakeem. He redshirted that whole year. And the next year, he began to play a little bit. But it was a concerted effort, but mostly a lot of effort by Hakeem. Even Coach Lewis, who thought he could teach any big man how to play the post. So Hakeem was blessed to have a coach like Guy Lewis and also a mentor like Moses Malone, who just happened to be the three-time MVP of the league at that time.
When did you know he was special? Because we all know when you see guys start now, you can see different little things, whether it's how they are in practice, how they are in certain games that no one's really watching. When did you first notice that Hakeem was special?
Well, he had a knack for blocking shots. And so Guy Lewis would encourage him to even goaltend sometimes just to intimidate people. So block the shots and go out to the rebounds. But offensively, you know, if you threw him the ball, he would travel. So in the game, you really couldn't throw him the ball because it was a turnover, right? So we developed this thing where I would do this. I said, anytime you're open, I can throw it up for the lob, right? So, and you know, he was our sixth man. He came off the bench my sophomore year. He redshirted my freshman year. And so he and I had great chemistry because he would always do this and I would throw it up and he would, you know, dunk it. And so every time we didn't connect, Coach Lewis let me know about it.
Yeah, turnover. Probably was a turnover, Clyde.
Exactly.
So is that how the five-star Majama started? Like, just because of that connection right there? Or what, could you tell us about that?
Well, you know, back then, University of Houston, we had great players. You had a guy named Larry Mitchell, 6'9", 250. the consummate power forward who played way above the rim, right? You had Michael Young, 6'7", small forward, who was strong bench pressing 400 pounds, who played way above the rim. You had guys like myself and Hakeem, guys who played way above the rim, who ran like gazelles. And then you had, I tell you, the best player was a guy named Rob Williams, who went hardship my sophomore year. But we had some great players, coached by a great coach at Guy Lewis. But Hakeem was special because he worked so darn hard to be special.
All right. So now, you know, you say in 1982, do you remember the game against North Carolina?
Yeah, I do. 83. North Carolina in 82 Final Four. Yes.
So they had Sam Perkins, James Worthy, and Michael Jordan on that team. How did y'all go with that team there? And then from the talent that you've seen from North Carolina, did you think those guys were pro material? And how did you compare that to your team?
Well, we played those guys, and we knew they were going to be good, folks. There were some really good quality players. James Worthy eventually went number one. Perkins had a great NBA career. Michael Jordan, well, we know about MJ, right? So that's an easy one. But at the time, we're all young guys. I'm a sophomore. It's not like anybody's old and seasoned. We're all trying to make our way, and we both were on two incredibly talented ball clubs. And so we lost that game by 5 points, but we got off to a very slow start. I think it was like 14-0. But we eventually hit our stride. We had a couple guys sick, a couple guys not playing well, and we still made a game of it. To lose by 5, even when North Carolina was stalling at the end, you know, back then they could run that 4 corners and run out the clock on you. So, but that was one great ball game. And you look back at it, there's some incredible players playing on both teams.
Yeah, it was. That's why I wanted to ask you about that, because, I mean – just now you think about the names on both teams, it's like, wow, like they had to have, you know, they had to be a great game in itself.
Let me tell you something. And both teams were very well coached. Dean Smith was a legend and Guy Lewis was a legend in the South. And so these are two teams that are well coached, tons of talent, and it's all about who's going to make the free throws, who's going to stop the other one, and who's going to execute offensively.
Hey, and you know, the crazy thing about, like, and Hakeem, he came off the bench, right?
Yep.
So, I don't know the matchup there, but how did he play, you know, in that moment right there on that stage against North Carolina? Because I'm sure that was pretty much, you know, brand new to him as well.
Yeah, it was very new. But Hakeem, I don't remember the exact stats, but he came off the bench. He was primarily a defensive player that year. Shot blocking, rebounding. I don't know if he, you know, I don't know what he did. If he tip dunked some offensive rebounds, which he was very capable of, he could do all of that. He didn't have the jump shot that he developed for the next year and the year after and beyond. But he had a couple of good moves on the post, a little jump hook, and he could score, but it wasn't the Hakeem that we knew had come to love.
Right.
Now, back then, you guys played differently than most schools. Like you mentioned, North Carolina, they stalled. You guys played an up-tempo type of basketball. You guys had a lot of athletes. You guys utilized them well. Do you guys think you guys were a bit ahead of your time?
We were way ahead of our time. But that was, you know, that team came together. It was a straight accident. Trust me. It was a straight accident. You know, Guy Lewis was a phenomenal coach. But, you know, I went to the University of Houston because I wanted to play with Rob Williams. It really didn't recruit me. Michael Young, who was the best, most recruited athlete in the state at that time, he and I were good friends. And we wanted to go to the same school. So U of H was not recruiting me. And I'm thinking, I would love to go there. And if I go there, I'm going to try to convince Mike to go there. And, you know, Larry Mishaw and Rob Williams were already there. So you have the foundation of a pretty good team. And so they finally called me. I ended up getting a scholarship offer. I convinced Mike to go. Well, he thought it was a great idea. And then a month later, Hakeem Olajuwon, somebody sends him Hakeem Olajuwon. They didn't really recruit Hakeem or myself.
Wow.
Okay. So
that team came together by faith. Trust me.
Now, with that being said, you mentioned you guys kind of randomly come together and you guys have the runs you guys had. Is there anything you look back on and wish you guys could have done differently or wish in your powers, like, you know what, we could do this differently or we would have had this lineup? Is there anything that you think that looking back on it that you'd have done differently?
Well, you and I both know there's no looking back. It's only forward. As I tell the guys, the following year we played at North Carolina State. We lost that game as well. And those guys played well. They were good teams, both of them. And they deserved to win on that day. But if we played a series best out of 10, I think it would come up differently. But in the college game, in the NCAA finals, it's one and done. The best team does not always win. But the team that executes well that day does. And so it puts a lot of pressure on you. But our team was used to having the pressure. You know, every game we played for a couple of years was highly, highly scrutinized. And so our guys were proven. They had shown under the lights that they were real. And so that's why the team was so good.
So you leave, you become the 14th pick in the NBA to the Portland Trail Blazers. Before, you know, when did you realize you were NBA ready? And who did you look up to in the game before you were even drafted?
Well, Pose, you know, you and I both know that in order to know that you can play in the NBA, you got to play against what? The NBA players. And so in living in Houston, it gave me an opportunity to play against a lot of NBA players at Fonday Recreation. And mm-hmm. all the players would be there, the college players, the pro players, the guys who played overseas. And yep. so just to get it up to play against those guys was a monumental feat. But then when you got on the court, you had to do something to stay up. Otherwise, you have to sit down for a couple hours. And so I knew I was going to be pretty good when Moses Malone started picking me over some of his teammates and started calling me Little Doc, you know, little Dr. J. So I knew I had a chance at that point. At that point, I was a high school senior.
Oh, and wow.
So going into U of H, most of the guys who were in the basketball world, they knew about Little Doc, who was me.
Wow. In 12th grade, that speaks volumes right there. What players in the NBA at the time did you sort of like, you know, like their game or thought you know, sort of compared your game to?
My favorite player post was Julius Erving. He was 6'7". You know, he had big hands. We could do stuff in the air most people couldn't do. So I took a lot of my stuff from Julius Erving and tried to, you know, just off the court, he's a super nice guy. On the court, super athlete, and just performed each and every night. Super durable, a great teammate. So I modeled that part after Julius. George Gervin was one of my favorites because George had all those really nice moves, the angles off the glass, the finger roll. Iceman was smooth, so I loved watching him play. But you had Clyde Frazier in New York. Clyde could steal the ball from anybody, whether on the dribble or in the passing lanes. And so I really enjoyed watching him to learn that part of the game. And so there was this guy named Randy Smith who played for the Buffalo Braves. Boy, did I love Randy Smith. He'd be running 100 miles an hour. He could stop and pop and make all of his shots or layups. The guy was super athletic. He was highly in motion all the time. And so he was one of my favorite players, Randy Smith. Played with Bob McAdoo on the Buffalo Braves.
Okay, I know Bob McAdoo. So how did you end up with your nickname, Clyde the Glide?
Oh, that was easy, folks. You know, once I in high school, I used to take off from so far, and I'd either dunk it, finger roll it, or just lay it high off the glass. And so it was an easy nickname, Clyde the Glide, because you take off from so far from the basket and finish with ease. You know, that was a badge of honor and a nickname that was very suitable, and it wasn't too corny. You know, back then, you had to have a nickname, but one thing you didn't want was one of those corny nicknames like Wild Helicopter.
Right. So your time in Portland playing with the Trailblazers, your first in the NBA Finals was against Detroit. Do you remember that? You remember that series?
Oh, absolutely. I remember every minute of every game. Absolutely. Because you lived it. I mean, the passion was there. That's why you played the game, to have a chance to play against the best players in the world on the biggest stage in the world. And so I had many opportunities to do just that.
So, so now you, that's, you know, you said that probably like the, your third there, and that's your first NBA Finals. Now you get back, of course, your second time is against the Chicago Bulls and MJ. Now, that Detroit series, did that sort of, you know, that gave you a little taste? So did you feel like, you know what I'm saying, going against, you know, the Bulls your second time around then would be a different outcome in that?
Well, think about it. We came out of nowhere to make the finals in 1990. And back in those days, when dinosaurs roamed the earth, only the dynasty teams were able to make it to the finals. You look at Detroit, back-to-back Pistons. You look at the Bulls, you know, three-peat. And even before the Bulls even made the finals, we made it in Portland, right? Mm-hmm. But it was the Lakers and it was the Celtics. That's who it was. Nobody else even sneaked in. Maybe, you know, somebody else may make it to the finals, but they're not going to beat those teams. And so when the Pistons, the Bulls, the Trailblazers, the Rockets started getting in that mix, it changed a lot of it, right? But only through in having great teams, great franchises, could you beat those dynasties. Because think about those Celtics teams. You got Parrish, Mikal, and Bird, DJ, and Ainge. That's five Hall of Famers. The Lakers, you got Magic, Worthy, Kareem, Michael Thompson, McAdoo, five guys who are number one picks overall. How are you going to beat those guys? So it was very difficult. So in 1990, we finally beat the Lakers and made it to the Western Conference Finals. The NBA Finals. And then 91, we got the best record in the league, but we lose to the Lakers in the Western Conference Finals, right? And in 92, we get the best record again, and we go to the finals to play against the Bulls. So we had a great run because they never expected us to do any of that. Trust me.
Now, looking back at those two final runs, when you look back at both teams, is there something in your mind that was missing from those teams, or was there like a missing piece that you guys could have added or didn't quite have to finish the job off?
You know, you always think, what if? But I think, you know, for the talent we had, you got to look at the talent we had. We had a bunch of guys who were second-round pick, late first-round pick. You know, we got the most out of the talent we had. Myself and Buck Williams were the lowest picks. And, you know, you again, those super teams have what? Think about the Pistons. They got Rodman. They got Lambeer. They got an all-star cast of Dumars and Thomas, Isaiah Thomas as the guards. You got Benny Johnson, the microwave, coming off the bench. You got John Sally off the bench, very serviceable 6'11 guy, right? James Edwards off the bench. Mark Aguirre off the bench. Think about all those great players.
Right.
You don't win without having a bunch of great players. And that's what it takes. And if you come up short, I mean, we were good enough to beat like 99% of the teams, but there was always some teams with great talent. Think about those Bulls teams we lost to. They got Michael. They got Scotty. They had Horace Grant. Later, they had Dennis Rodman. But Bill Cartwright was a very serviceable center. Think about that. And Michael was always surrounded by with a great shooter like Craig Hodges or Steve Kerr or John Paxson. And so they got B.J. Armstrong, all these good players, man. You go, it's hard to beat those good teams. And they're well coached. So the fact that you're fighting year after year means you're in the game.
Got you. And I'll take it back a little bit. You go from being in Houston, going to high school, going to college in Houston, and getting drafted by the Trailblazers. What was that first trip like to Portland? Because Portland is nothing like Houston.
Well, Portland was a polar opposite. And that's not a bad thing. They're both great cities. But coming from the inner city of Houston, where most of my friends were black, my schooling was black. Up until I went to U of H, I had all black teachers. I went to a church, it was all black. My whole neighborhood was black. So it's like I was being in a black environment. And so even though Houston is very diverse, when I went to Portland, it was 99% white. And so it couldn't have been more dramatic. But, you know, the people were so nice. They loved their Trailblazers. And I was there, you know, for a job. And so you just got to do what you can do. Even though the city closed down at 6 o'clock back in those days, you know, that gave me more time to get into the lab and work on my game.
Nice. Because they always talk about Portland not being able to draw free agents and no one wants to stay there after their rookie contract's up. But you stayed there a while. Is there something that you would tell guys and say, hey, like, this place ain't that bad?
Well, 11 and a half years I stayed there. And I would have stayed as long as my 15 years were up, because I was only going to play 15 years, right? I always said if I was blessed enough to play in the NBA, I only want to play 15 years. I don't want to stay too long because I want to be healthy and happy afterwards, right? So that was my thought from the beginning, and I only played 15 years. But here's the key. Portland was the team that drafted me. Other teams passed on me. Right. To me, that's loyal. I'm going to be loyal as long as they're loyal. The only reason I left, I could have left years ago and got paid big money going to New York. I mean, some James Posey money. But they were the team that drafted me. The Rockets passed, the Dallas Mavericks passed, a bunch of teams in Texas passed on me coming out of the draft, even though I had an impeccable college career. So I was always loyal, and I was going to torture all of those teams that passed. For years, I did. And so the only reason I left Portland, they were starting to rebuild. Because after all those great years, I had some injuries on my knee. And they kind of gave up a little bit too soon. Mm. And so they started rebuilding. They got rid of Kevin Duckworth. And I was like, hold up, guys. We don't have a center. And then they started saying, well, we need to rebuild. We need to trade some of these veterans while they can still play so we can get something for them. And that's when I orchestrated the trade to Houston. But if they had not done that, I would have finished my career there out of loyalty.
Out of loyalty. That's what's up. That's what's missing a lot nowadays, too. But
you have both sides.
Yeah, on both sides. Right, exactly. So, but before you ended up in Houston, you became a member of that dream team. Could you tell us, you know, how those practices were and how that came about? Like, did you even know that you were, you know, either considered to be a member of that dream team? How did that happen?
Well, you know, that year, I think we actually played against the Bulls in the finals. We lose in six games. A great series. MJ and his team were awesome. It was a pleasure to play against them. We came up just short. Every game was close. If you look at that sixth game, we were up by 15 going into the fourth quarter, and it was in Chicago. So a game seven we thought was going to be on the horizon, but the Bulls picked it up and played so much better in that fourth quarter. We ended up losing by three, right? Right. And so, you know, back then, you really just had to do the best you can. And your question again posed was what?
The dream team, how did that come about? You know, say they talk about the outside factors, or did you just think your game in itself deserved to be on there? Or, you know what I'm saying, like some people were snubbed from it, or, you know, other people could have been well deserving of it. But did you actually think that you really belonged on that team?
Well, that year I came in second in the league in MVP voting to you know who. Michael Jordan. And obviously I'd been in the finals for two or three straight years and one of the premier players in the game. I should have been the second name they call to right. be on that team. Let me just tell you. And everybody knows it. But the fact that I got on it was a tremendous honor. It was a great team. And Pose, if you know me, you know I'm not too keen about practice anyway. Especially at the end of being in a long NBA season. You're in the NBA Finals, you're playing till June, and now we're going to take 2 weeks off and we're right into the Olympics. Well, I'm so tired, I couldn't even pay attention, right? So, you know I'm not a big practice guy anyway, but there was some great practices. I had a knee problem, so I was trying to survive the experience so I could participate. So I was not one who was trying to show up for practice, trust me.
That's crazy. So like you said a few minutes ago, you orchestrated the trade to get you and you come back home to Houston Rockets. Now you're also back reunited with Hakeem. How was that? And did you expect big things and win it like you guys did?
Well, from the 92 finals, I had a knee surgery right after the Olympics, which I had been putting off until March. So it took me 2 years to get back completely healthy. And by this time, I'm in my 12th year in the league. And, you know, people are looking at you like, the way they look at Chris Paul now, well, he may be past his prime, right? But you still can play. And if you still can play, you can still play. That's what that means. Right. And so I got healthy, orchestrated the trade, got to play with my good friend, Hakeem Olajuwon, in a great Houston Rockets franchise. Rudy Tomjanovich, Robert Horry, Mario Ellie, Kenny Smith, Sam Cassell, you know, Chucky Brown, Pete Chilcutt, Charlie Jones, Amigo, Carl Herrera. These guys were great players, man. Just really good basketball players. And so because they won the title the year before, it was a pleasure to join those guys and make another run for a title. And of course, we got lucky.
You know, luck, hey, perfect time and all the stars lined up and you win. You put in the work and you win. Hey, that's at the end of the season, you're trying to win a championship. So ain't no luck that.
Well, you know what it's like. You got to be good enough and lucky enough and healthy enough to be on a team that's good enough to win it. There are a lot of intangibles that have to come together.
Right.
You know what that's like.
Yep.
Now, how was it getting traded in the middle of a season to a team that had just won it? Because that transition didn't go through the smoothest. And the Rockets didn't have the greatest of years that year. How was that whole experience of, you know, getting dealt middle of the season and joining a team that had championship aspirations but didn't necessarily have a great record that year?
No, they were struggling. And they really weren't getting along off the court either. And that was part of the problem. So they knew they had to break it up. Now, not many people would have the guts or the gall to break up a championship team without giving them a run at the title. But they were so bad. It was so broken. They had to do something. And so I was contacted. And so when I was contacted, I was like, hey, Portland, they need to rebuild because they're trying to rebuild anyway. We don't have a center. And I want to fight for a title because guess what? I'm healthy and can do all the things I had been doing the previous three or four seasons, right? And so my last 3 years, I wanted to fight for a title. And so going to Houston made perfect sense. I called Hakeem. I called the general manager. They were definitely interested. I said, well, hey, let's make it happen. And sure enough, we all worked together and made it happen. But and looking back at it, it was the best move I ever made.
Now, when you first get to Houston, how was it going against guys like Vernon Maxwell and Kenny Smith and Sam Cassell and all those guards out there that are very competitive and got guys that with a chip on their shoulder? How was that when you first got there?
Well, you know, I had been playing against those guys for years. So it's not like I didn't know them, right? But they were better guys off the court because you get to know them. But Maxwell was great. Kenny Smith was phenomenal. Mario Ellie was just incredible. Robert Horry, he wasn't happy at first, but he grew to love the trade. And Sam Cassell was always super nice. And Hakeem and I were both ecstatic. And that was the key. And the coaching staff truly bought in. They knew we were going to be better. And so they were super nice from day one.
I'm going to jog your memory a little bit too. So, you know, I get drafted by the Denver Nuggets in 99. I want to say it was either my rookie year or my second year there. I know you was part of, I guess, the front office there. You know, you and Kiki were good friends. And I remember having a little convo with you. You know, like I said, I knew you from afar, but that was my first time meeting you in person and everything. And you came up to me and you was like, I'm gonna tell you a way to average 20 points. And I was like, what? And so you sort of broke it down to me. I probably got it all wrong now, but it was like maybe like a three, two threes. You need one in the first half, second half. You need a layup or something, one a quarter, and then you get to the free throw line, like that's your 20 points. And then you're gonna get little points here and there. It was like, yo, like you telling me how to average 20 points. That ain't my game, but I was like, thanks for the information. So that information that you gave me, is that sort of how you play the game?
Absolutely. Think about it, folks. I mean, you're going to get a couple offensive rebounds if you're on the court. You should, right? With our athleticism, you should, especially from the guard position. I'm a Bogard two or three offensive rebounds every game, trust me. So I'm going to get two to 6 points off that. I'm going to get a couple steals playing the passing lanes. That's four more points every game. I'm going to run into about five people every chance I get. I'm going to get me about six to seven free throws, right? That's 17 points already. If I make one three, that's 20. And I haven't even worked that hard. But that's how you got to think about being efficient, because a coach has to know, what can I count on you for every night, right? Right. And guys, some guys don't have an answer for that. I always had an answer for that.
I guess mine is just defense because, hey, there's no way I could have, there's no way I put that together to get 20 points. Hey, I was just happy to get in double digits most nights, but 20 points, that was a lot. But, hey, I'm glad you thought that highly of me to give me that information.
Well, I saw you were a talent, folks, and I knew you could do it. And because you hadn't thought of yourself like that, right? True. I knew what your talent should bring with your athleticism and your length, your ability to shoot the ball. Now, if I can get you to get some hustle points and get some easy buckets along with that talent, dude, that's 20 easy. By the half, some nights.
Still by the half. Oh, man.
And that's why it was hard to stop guys who always had a plan on how to score. I'm going to try to out-hustle you every night. And the nights my jumper's working, you might get 40, 45.
Yeah, right. And that's what I want to ask you, too. So now in today's game a little bit, you talk about the two guard, which position that you play. It was more of a scoring guard there. Everybody knew that position was a score. Is that position sort of missing now where it's more you have a scoring point guard in itself and they do the bulk of the scoring? Or does that two guard position still hold that title as like being the scoring option?
I don't know, Pose. Every team is different. The point guards now are so potent. They can score from anywhere on the court. You can't tell those guys not to shoot. They're the best players on most of their teams, like Steph Curry, like Damian Lillard. I mean, Kyrie Irving, James Harden. I mean, all these guys, Chris Paul. So they can score whenever they want, believe it or not. Ben Simmons. But the two guards, if they're talented, they can score whenever they want. There's nothing but opportunity. Nothing but opportunity. Work on your skill set, and if you want to be effective, find a way to become more efficient. And as a two guard, I had a matchup advantage every single night against every single team. Being 6'7", about 235, 240, I could out-jump, out-run, and out-post every two guard in the league. So which made them have matchup problems for life. And so they usually put 6'9", 6'10", guys on me to keep me from posting. And all I did was take them from the outside, bring them back to the basket, and get easy layups. And if they put a small guy on me, I'm posting him every time. You better double and triple me. And so those are the plans that made you effective and efficient. And so some guys just don't have a plan, you know. You got to have a plan. What you just can't be out there playing. You got to have a plan to be effective. And so I was very structured, very to the point. And this is what I'm going to do, and there's nothing you can do to stop me.
Wow. So who was like the one guy or players that you like night in, night out that you like, man, it's going to be a long night? Not saying that they would dominate you or nothing like that, but you just knew you always had to be on your A game when y'all played them.
Well, back in the day, there were a lot of guys that would light you up. If you weren't on your A defensive game, I mean, guys like Ricky Pierce, Rolando Blackman, guy like Mitch Richmond. I mean, those guys, they don't get a lot of press, but Alex English. Dude, they would have field days if you didn't bring your game. Even a guy like Joe Dumars, Reggie Miller. I mean, I could name a guy on every team, Dale Ellis, Lafayette Lever. All these guys would light you up back in the day. And they never got – you never hear their names. And they were incredible players.
Mm-hmm. Well, Clyde, how would your career would have been different if you played in today's era? So let's say you started in 2008, instead of the mid-80s. How would your career would have gone with the way the offense is these days and the way the game is played?
Well, first of all, they wouldn't have enough money under the cap. I would be the cap. I hate to say it, guys, because I respect the guys today so much. We can always talk about different eras. The key is, what did you do in your era? That's all you can judge it by. But today's game, obviously, it seems a lot easier because there's no hand checking at all. And for a guy who probably drove the most in the NBA during my career, I probably had more dribble drives to the basket than any player in the history of the NBA. So what do you think I would do with no hand checking? Oh, my God.
Posters. It'd be some posters out there.
Oh, my God. It would be a lot of fun. But I take nothing away from the players today. I love watching them play.
Got you. Now, how do you feel about all these lists that come out? Seems like every day there's some sort of comparison or list. There's always like a top five shooting guard or top 10 shooting guards, all those kind of lists. How do you feel about that? And where do you place yourself on that list?
Dude, I've been from number three to number 10. And that and $10 will get you a ticket at the movie. You know, it's, to me, it was an honor just to make the team, just to put on that Trailblazer jersey. That was my dream come true. Everything that was all downhill, guys. But, you know, we played the game because we loved it. We competed with passion each and every night. And here's the key. Everywhere I played my whole career, sold out. Every city, from the University of Houston to Portland, who had sellouts before I got there, but certainly after I left, and even to the Houston Rockets, who did not have sellouts, even though they won the championship the year before. I get there, they sell out. And when I retire, they stop selling out. So my 15 years, I sold out every place I played, which tells you at least people thought you were worth watching. That's an ultimate compliment.
Right.
Definitely, definitely. Now, how did you get into media? Because I remember after you played, you coached at the University of Houston, then I see you do color commentary for the Rockets and also doing other stuff. And I really remember in 2004, you were the only person on television to say the Pistons would beat the Lakers. That wasn't from Detroit or anything like that. You were the only person that I heard over that whole week stretch before that final started. So how did you get into the media? Was that a goal or did you just kind of stumble into that? How did that come about?
That's a good question. I kind of stumbled into it. After you get through playing, the one thing you have is a lot of knowledge, right, Poles? We know this game. We built this game. And so there's nothing better than talking about it because you still love the game. And so that was a way to stay involved to the degree, you know, because I didn't want to do anything that I had to do every day. I got to wake up and do it every day. I'm out. I'm not doing that ever. Let me tell you, I played too hard to do that. But if I could show up, you know, 2 days a week, maybe sometimes one, and talk about the game we love. And you know, my son loved the game, so it was a father-son thing we did together. And so it was fun. I did it for about 16 years, and it's a lot of fun. Talking about the game from our perspective, because when I first started doing the broadcast for the Houston Rockets, you know, even the commentators who were good guys, they didn't know what they were doing. Every black player was athletic, and he was just gifted, and every white player was so smart. He's such a leader. I changed that tremendously. Right. And I let the guys know how I felt about all of that. And so that I changed that narrative tremendously, right? And so I feel good about that.
You had a little stint in coaching as well. What players today would you mind coaching, and what players do you like?
Dude, I don't have the patience for coaching. You couldn't get me to show up for practice every day. Even when I played, what do you think about coach? Not in my game plan, let me tell you. But the players today are highly coachable. They listen. They want to get better. They want to improve. And so it seems, you know, it seems these young guys, even though they make a lot of money, they do listen. Guys, when we played post, they didn't listen to a damn thing. Only they wanted to hear that number call. Is it my number? Is it my play? That was it.
Right. They need the ball.
Absolutely.
So you're done playing a little bit, and you got involved with this with the Big Three, with Ice Cube, you know, his lead, the Big Three. How did that come about? And what do you think how you think is going compared to like the NBA, like the former players there getting the opportunity to play again?
I think it's great. Ice Cube and the Big Three is one of the most popular games in the world. Jeff Quantnitz, Ice Cube's business partner, is a co-founder. Those guys put together an incredible game plan. Professional 3-on-3 half court. It's been so popular, Pose. Guys, the players love it. The fans love it. I'm the commissioner of the Big Three, and it's been a pleasure to be a part of it because it keeps your foot in basketball, which is the game we love, you know. The first black commissioner, come on.
Right.
Love it.
Congrats.
And, you know, and it's a great game played by some of the best players in the world. Outside of the NBA, It's the most professional league in the world with that kind of talent. And playing half court only one game a week, these guys go at it. So our games are action-packed, and every team wants to win. So they don't dial it in, folks. They come to play, and that's what makes it so special.
Yeah, I mean, it looks competitive and, you know, a little feisty at times, but, you know, I guess the fans get their money's worth as well, but it's an opportunity for guys to see their favorite players that they didn't really get a chance to see, or some of the younger players growing up, you know, having that opportunity to see those guys as well.
And it's hard to make one of those big three teams. Let me tell you, the competition is fierce, because you got to be able to be a two-way player, James. You can't be a specialist in the big three.
Right.
You got to be able to score, especially in isolation, or to shoot the open shot to space the court. And you definitely have to be able to rebound and defend. And so you got to be a full-time player. Those rosters are very difficult to make.
So you're done. Like we talked earlier about your golf game. You know, is that pretty much what you're doing now? You know, outside of basketball, on the golf course, serving. Well, what's your handicap, man?
Suppose I do a lot, but I don't want nobody to know, because they're gonna want too many strokes. But I do a lot of stuff, folks. I still do my airport concessions. I have a real estate company. I do a ton of stuff, but everything I do, I really enjoy, and most of it is my own creations. And life is good. Let me tell you.
Well, who's the better golfer between you two?
Well, James started late. You know, he you retired in what year, folks?
12.
Yeah, so, you know, I had about a 30-year head start on him.
Hey, J-Mo, hey, that's messed up, J-Mo. Come on, man.
I hear about is you guys golfing all the time. I had to know. The people want to know.
Well, maybe I should
be a good golfer. He's going to be a good golfer eventually.
Okay. Maybe I should have said I get lessons from Clyde more. You know what I'm saying? Maybe I should have said that then.
There you go.
Like, beat the man.
Hey, but he get more style points, you know. He came out here with his music player.
Hey, I'm going to be clean. I'm going to be sharp. You know, I'm going to be sharp out there now. My game ain't matching yet, but I'm working on it. He's working on it.
And that's what it does. It gets you away from everything you're thinking about for the entire day. Golf is the best sport ever. Trust me. After basketball, you can't ask for a better hobby. And how Posey and I talk, we say, what do guys do who don't fish or golf as a hobby? What do they do?
Right. Now, you know, you golf and everything. We have our little conversation, too. So, you know, MJ, he golf as well. I know a few times y'all get together and golf. How is that? Is he trash talking? Are y'all both trash talking? Like, how is the focus? Because you got to have focus to play that game, too.
No, you got to have focus. MJ and I are very kind. Nothing but complimentary and supportive. No trash talking, but definitely competitive. Definitely competitive. And it's always a lot of fun. I tell you what, his course in Jupiter, I don't know if it's in Jupiter or right outside of Jupiter, but it's very close. It is a phenomenal course. It's called Grove 23, one of the greatest golf experiences I've ever had. If you get a chance, well, it is a private course, but if I lived in that area, Post, I would definitely join that club. Grove 23 is a first-class golfing experience.
Wow.
Michael Jordan laid it out, dude.
Wow, okay. Yeah, when I get my game together, maybe I might get an invite or something. Maybe I get an invite.
That's the only way I'm going to be there.
Nah, man. So, you know, today's world with the social injustice, and we got the election coming up, you know, what's your thoughts and feelings about things to come and things that has happened?
Well, obviously, things need to change. The systemic stuff. We need better housing, better access to capital. Number one, we need quality when it comes to the Justice Department. Equality is the key word. We just want the same thing, same treatment everybody else gets, no less, no more. We want the police to stop harassing, intimidating, incarcerating our kids. We want to feel safe because we pay our taxes, we live in this country, and not all policemen are bad. But enough of them are bad. And when they are caught doing something that's unscrupulous, we need to make them accountable because they make the good police officers look extremely bad. And so that's why we have a problem. If the good police officers call out the bad police officers, guess what? We would not have a problem. Right. That's all they got to do. When somebody makes mistakes, hold them accountable. It doesn't reflect everybody, But that person who did it, don't you dare say that he didn't do anything when he's on camera, big as day, you know, taking someone's life unnecessarily. So we got to get rid of the hate. Got to have more love in this world, folks. Everybody, there's enough for everybody. So nobody's taking anything from you. Just learn to love people and be kind. That's what this world is all about.
I appreciate you coming on, but before we get out of here, I have a segment called Free Game. What free game can you give to the people out here that's going to listen or see this? And it could be anything you want to hit on, but it's just free game for the people out here in this world to live every day with.
Free game, wake up and be the best you that you can be every day. And that's, you know, whether it's saying something to make someone's day by a compliment or just being helpful in any little way you can, because you never know what people are going through. And so it's important to be kind. It's more important to be kind than anything, and treat people the way you'd like to be treated. And try not to fall short too many times of that. I mean, we all, that's part of the golden rule, but try to treat people the way you'd like to be treated. That's what I try to do every day. And when I fall short, I feel so bad. But I think that's something we all should strive for.
There y'all have it. Free game from Clyde Glide Drexler. Man, appreciate you. Friendship that we built over the past couple of years. Thank you for everything and taking the time out to be on the Posecast. Appreciate
Pose,
you.
I'm delighted to be here. Proud of you. Next time, make sure you give me a hot dog when we play.
I always get a hot dog. I owe milkshakes and everything. Come on, man. Come on. But I appreciate it. Thanks, CD.
All right, Pose. Continued success. Pleasure. All right.
Yo, this is James Posey. Thanks for checking out Posecast, brought to you by basketballnews.com. You can check out Posecast every Thursday on all your listening platforms.
Presenting sponsor of the Posecast is greensupply.com. With everything going on in the world, it is more important than ever to stay safe. At greensupply.com, you can purchase masks, hand sanitizer, and other important health and wellness products, all in stock with same-day shipping. Best of all, listeners can get 10% off their order when using the promo code POSEY at checkout. That's POSEY for 10% off your order of KN95 or cloth mask, hand sanitizer, or other supplies like forehead thermometers and UV boxes. Visit greensupply.com. That's greensupply.com today.